Blog Talk Radio.
This program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Basically, the 1% of the motorcycle community who operates outside the law.
Their total focus is on hatred for the enemy. They have a policy of shoot or kill on sight if they can.
It's bullshit. Law enforcement just tries to paint this picture to the media to just cover up their bullshit, cover up their lies, and I just like to say fuck them. That's straight from Mike P.
Jump on your bike, let's hit the road.
Come on.
Fuck the 5-0, man, we out of control.
Hey.
I'm a bad motherfucker, riding through the night. Yeah. A 50 motherfucker and I love to fucking fight. Picture me rolling on my chopper on red. No love for the other side, no need to be friends. Just a gas, homie, you gotta keep on pissing. Got an out, cheer, check the dose, and need an ass with a ticket. That's a ticket, man, I ain't gon' pay. Got a dude 30 days locked up in CJ. Let's twist the throttle, let's hit the rolling. My drag bike on my bike, get the blowin'. A third motherfucker street calling me. Like a mom calls the kids when it's time to eat.
Come on.
Approach me, homie, like the shit all good. I'm like half the motherfuckers that live in my hood. I'm a 10-year roller to the mall. With 10 in the clip and 1 in the hole. Fuck what you heard, homie. I'ma always hit a bar. My home was my rubber, but we never ever fall. At the end of the day, we can always stand tall. The gov don't like me, yo, fucking way. I guess you can call me the angel from hell.
Well, hello, buddy. Got an interesting story here. And once I get this shit out of the way here, let's see. Okay. We had this interesting story about bikers heard this Marine's remains were coming home in the United States Postal Service box. They stepped up in a big way. According to news story, Staff Sergeant Jonathan Turner served 7 tours in Iraq and Afghanistan and died last week in California from combat-related injuries. His mother was unable to make the trip from Georgia to California for the funeral, and the Marine Corps handled all of their funeral arrangements, including shipping Staff Sergeant ashes back home. And it didn't sit well with the Patriot Guard riders, so they stepped up by creating a caravan and personally escorting his remains all the way across the country. One gentleman said, I got on the road at 6 o'clock Friday night out of Huntsville, Alabama, and rode over to Oklahoma. I need the family to know you're not alone, we care. Each time the remains were turned over to another group of riders, the ceremony was held to pay respects for the fallen warrior. We do this primarily because his mother was unable to attend the services and he had been cremated, and we didn't want him to go home in a FedEx box. Oklahoma Patriot Guard Riders Captain David Noble said. There's a little view here, so I'll let... let them tell us what happened. Oh, here we go.
I am very proud that North
they got a stick in the
Carolina Furniture Mart has been in my family.
Hold on, this is like 15 seconds.
Please come and see what we have to offer. Shopping with people who know furniture makes all the difference. We are open every day.
Can't get away from this commercial.
Oklahoma's own helping a U.S. Marine reach his final resting place. Staff Sergeant Jonathan Turner served 7 tours in Iraq and Afghanistan with the Marines and recently died in California from combat-related issues. His mother is in Georgia, and when the nonprofit Patriot Guard Riders heard his ashes were supposed to be mailed home, they decided to organize a chain of motorcycle riders across the country to give the Marine a more dignified final trip home. Saturday, riders from Oklahoma took Turner through the Sooner State to the Arkansas border, where they handed him off to the next group of riders.
Thank you, Oklahoma. We appreciate your service.
We did this primarily because his mother was unable to attend the services, and he had been cremated. And we didn't want him to go home in a FedEx box.
When the journey comes to an end, Staff Sergeant Turner's remains will have passed through 7 states.
Did you call him never giving up? No man left behind, even in death. I was going to talk about a couple of things today, but I'm going to shift gears a little bit. My counterparts haven't checked in yet, but this is one of the most badass men in the history of the Army, Master Gunnery Sergeant or Master Sergeant Roy Benavides. Watch this video and listen to what President Reagan reading the complete citations for his perilous actions while wounded. Listen to him speak in the parts that follow. This is truly a humble and amazing leader.
Morning of May 2nd, 1968, a 12-man Special Forces reconnaissance team was inserted by helicopters in a dense jungle area west of Loc Ninh, Vietnam, to gather intelligence information about confirmed large-scale enemy activity. This area was controlled and routinely patrolled by the North Vietnamese Army. After a short period of time on the ground, the team met heavy enemy resistance and requested emergency extraction. Three helicopters attempted extraction, but were unable to land due to intense enemy small arms and anti-aircraft fire. Sergeant Benavides was at the forward operating base in Loc Ninh monitoring the operation by radio when these helicopters returned to offload wounded crew members and to assess aircraft damage. Sergeant Benavides voluntarily boarded a returning aircraft to assist in another extraction attempt. Realizing that all the team members were either dead or wounded and unable to move to the pickup zone, he directed the aircraft to a nearby clearing where he jumped from the hovering helicopter and ran approximately 75 meters under withering small arms fire to the crippled team. Prior to reaching the team's position, he was wounded in his right leg, face, and head. Despite these painful injuries, he took charge, repositioning the team members and directing their fire to facilitate the landing of an extraction aircraft and the loading of wounded and dead team members. He then threw smoke canisters to direct the aircraft to the team's position. Despite his severe wounds and under intense enemy fire, he carried and dragged half of the wounded team members to the awaiting aircraft. He then provided protective fire by running alongside the aircraft as it moved to pick up the remaining team members. As the enemy's fire intensified, he hurried to recover the body and the classified documents on the dead team leader. When he reached the team leader's body, Sergeant Benavides was severely wounded by small arms fire in the abdomen and grenade fragments in his back. At nearly the same moment, the aircraft pilot was mortally wounded and his helicopter crashed. Although in extremely critical condition due to his multiple wounds, Sergeant Benavides secured the classified documents and made his way back to the wreckage, where he aided the wounded out of the overturned aircraft and gathered the stunned survivors into a defensive perimeter. Under increasing enemy automatic weapons and grenade fire, he moved around the perimeter, distributing water and ammunition to his weary men, reinstilling in them a will to live and fight. Facing a buildup of enemy opposition with a beleaguered team, Sergeant Benavides mustered his strength and began calling in tactical airstrikes and directing the fire from supporting gunships to suppress the enemy's fire and so permit another extraction attempt. He was wounded again in his thigh by small arms fire while administering first aid to a wounded team member just before another extraction helicopter was able to land. His indomitable spirit kept him going as he began to carry his comrades to the craft. On his second trip with the wounded, he was clubbed from behind by an enemy soldier. In the ensuing hand-to-hand combat, he sustained additional wounds to his head and arms before killing his adversary. He then continued under devastating fire to carry the wounded to the helicopter. Upon reaching the aircraft, he spotted and killed two enemy soldiers who were rushing the craft from an angle that prevented the aircraft door gunner from firing upon them. With little strength remaining, he made one last trip to the perimeter to ensure that all classified material had been collected or destroyed and to bring in the remaining wounded. Only then, in serious condition from numerous wounds and loss of blood, did he allow himself to be pulled into the extraction aircraft. Sergeant Benavides' gallant choice to join voluntarily his comrades who were in critical straits, to expose himself constantly to withering enemy fire, and his refusal to be stopped despite numerous severe wounds saved the lives of at least eight men. His fearless personal leadership, tenacious devotion to duty, and extremely valorous of overwhelming odds, were in keeping with the finest traditions of the military service and reflect the utmost credit on him and the United States Army. Sergeant Benedictus, a nation grateful to you and to all your comrades living and dead, awards you its highest symbol of gratitude. For service above and beyond the call of duty, the Congressional Medal of Honor.
In Spanish, in German, danke schön, in Japanese, arigato ne, and in French, merci beaucoup. Thank you very much. I don't speak those languages fluently, but I'll never get lost in those countries if I ever go there. Thank you very much to the Million Dollar Roundtable for inviting me to come and be along with these other eloquent speakers. I come from a little town named Cuero, Texas. I was born there, in the Turkey capital of the world. After the death of my mother and father, at an early age, my brother and I were adopted by an aunt and uncle. We moved to El Campo, Texas, a town southwest of Houston, about 9.5. I was raised there. I went to school there. I worked at jobs there. Shine shoes, sold papers, picked cotton. And like a fool, I dropped out of school and I ran away from home. I'm not proud of that. I needed to learn a skill. I needed an education. My adopted father would tell me, son, an education and a diploma is the key to success. Bad habits and bad company will ruin you. Well, I was too old to go back to school. I didn't want to return back, so I joined the Texas National Guard. And I liked what I saw in men in uniform. And I qualified to join the regular army. I needed that education and learn the skill. So I was accepted into the regular army. And I heard about airborne. I heard about that extra pay that you get for jumping out of airplanes. So I qualified to go to jump school at Fort Benning, Georgia. But the darn recruiters never told me what the training was like. For every mistake that you make, you do push-ups. And I can honestly tell you, ladies and gentlemen, I'm one of the guys that helped put Georgia into South Carolina doing push-ups. Well, I finished my training. I got assigned to a well-known unit at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, the 82nd Airborne Division. I like the 82nd, thank you. Airborne all the way. I like that. And so, after a while there, I heard about the Special Forces. You know it as the Green Berets. And they were coming up, so I qualified to join the Special Forces. Of course, I'm a linguist. We in the Special Forces are trained to operate deep behind enemy lines with little or no support at all. We are trained in 5 specialties. I'm trained in 3. Operation Intelligence, where I learn oceanography, meteorology, photography. I'm an interrogator and I'm a linguist. I'm trained in light and heavy weapons and cross-trained as a medic. I've been all over the world, the Far East, Europe, South and Central America, and 2 tours in Vietnam. I was assigned to Berlin, Germany. And I was declared one time that I was the only Hispanic American that could speak German with a Southern accent. So I came back and retrained at Fort Bragg, and Vietnam was brewing up. In 1965, I was sent to Vietnam as an advisor to a Vietnamese infantry unit. After a short period of time there, mine. I woke up in the Philippine Islands in Clark Air Force Base. I was paralyzed from the waist down. I was declared never to walk again. I was transferred to Fort Sam Houston, Texas Beach Pavilion. The doctor who initiated my medical discharge paper. But at night, I would slip out of bed and crawl to a wall using my elbows and my chin. My back would just be killing me. I'd be crying. But I'd get to the wall and I'd set myself against the wall and I'd back myself up against the wall and I'd stand there like Elijah the Indian. I'd stand there and move my toes right and left, right. Every single chance I got. I wanted to walk. I wanted to go back to Vietnam because of what the news media was saying about us, our president not needed there to burn the flag and what. And I saw a lot of other patients coming back, limbs missing. I wanted to go back. I was determined because I remember when I was taught in jump school, our old master sergeant would tell me, Benavides, quitters never win and winners never quit. What are you? I'm a winner. And I remember in my special work. And I remember in my special forces training, one of the training missions that I was on, I remember that my leader would tell me, faith, determination, and a positive attitude. A positive attitude will carry you further than ability. You can do it, Benavides. You can do it. I never forgot those three words. Never. So there I was at night. I'd slip out of bed. The nurses would catch me sometimes. They would chew me out, give me a pill, a sleeping pill, put me to sleep. They would tell the doctors in the morning. I was determined to go. 9 months later, here comes my medical discharge paper. And I told the doctor, Doctor, look what I can do. He said, Sergeant, I'm sorry. Even if you can stand up, you'll never be able to walk. Jumped out of bed and I stood up right before him. My back was hurting, aching. I was crying. And I moved just a little bit. The doctor said, Benavides, if you walk out of this room, I'll tear this papers up. I walked out of that ward at Beach Pavilion. I walked out with a limp. I went back to Fort Bragg, North Carolina. I started my therapy again, running 5 or 10 miles a day, doing 1,500 push-ups. And I made 3 parachute jumps in 1 day. I was ready to go back to Vietnam, physically and mentally ready to go back. My orders were to go to Central America as an advisor. But being a non-commissioned officer and knowing some of the good officers in the right places, my orders were diverted. So I went back to Vietnam in 1968. The latter part of April, I was inserted, my buddy and I, to gather intelligence information behind enemy lines. After 2 days on the ground, my buddy was shot through the eye, the back, and the legs. Our mission was completed, but I didn't want to leave my buddy behind. I called in for an extraction helicopter to come and get us out. They came in with the McGuire rig. McGuire rig is nothing but a piece of rope, nylon rope, to hook. In this case, there were 2 ropes. We hooked on, the enemy was firing at us. We pulled up, one up through the canopy of the jungle. Our rope started to twist and rub. You know, nylon, it burns when it rubs. As we cleared the canopy, our rope was completely twisting and rubbing. And there was a non-commissioned officer that looked out of the helicopter and riding as a safety man. And when he saw those 2 ropes burning, he immediately tied himself with a piece of rope around his waist and he pulled himself out of the helicopter and undid those 2 ropes, separated them. That's dedication. That's love of fellow man and country. I'll never forget that man. And the enemy was still firing at us, but they never shot us. We landed We landed in a safe spot. My buddy was taken to the hospital shortly thereafter he expired. I was in another staging area waiting for our next assignment. When I heard on the radio something like a popcorn machine, then I heard a voice, "Get us out of here, get us out of here, come in and get us out quick, ASAP." I asked the radio operator, "Who are those?" He said, "I don't know. They haven't gave us any call sign." And I saw some helicopter pilots run to the flight line, scrambling. I ran right behind them. We saw a helicopter coming in, land, and had a door gunner slumped over his weapon. When the helicopter landed, I unstrapped the door gunner, Michael Craig, 19 years old. We just celebrated 19th birthday in March. I cradled him in my arms, and his last words were, "My God, my mother and father." I asked the pilot, "Who are the people on the ground?" He said, "Hey," he said, "it's that black NCO, that non-commissioned officer saved your life the other day, remember?" I said, "Leroy Wright." Leroy always got picked for top secret assignments, him and Musso and O'Connor. So there was an instant reaction. I saw a bag of medical supplies, picked it up, went over to my helicopter. Got on the helicopter. We got on with the forward air controller, the guy saying, he said, "You can't go in there, you can't go in. It's too hot." Little did I know that I was going to spend 6 hours in the hell. You heard what the president read the citation of how I earned the Medal of Honor. But he didn't tell you of what I went through when I engaged in the hand-to-hand combat. I was hit in the mouth on the butt of the weapon. My jaws were locked. After my last return back to the helicopter, when I was boarded on, I was holding my intestines in my hand. We lifted up the helicopter, had it over its payload. Blood was flowing on both sides of the helicopter. When we landed, it locked me in my staging area and started unloading, started identifying the bodies. They found out I loaded 3 dead enemy soldiers in that helicopter. I didn't want to leave anybody behind. My mission was to recover the classified material, so if anybody had it, he was on the helicopter. So they let the 3 enemy soldiers on the side, and because I sort of look Oriental, they thought I was one of them, so they let me lay right next to them. And they were putting us in body bags. And I remember my feet being lifted, and I was inserted into the body bag, and I could hear that zipper coming up, and I thought, "Oh my God, no, no." My eyes were shut because I had blood all over my face, and the blood had dried up in my eyelids. And I couldn't talk because my jaws were locked, and I could hear that zipper coming up, and one of my buddies was doing the Mexican head dance, and he was yelling at the doctor, that's Roy Benavidez. Doctor said, "Sorry, there's nothing I can do for him." Oh my God, the zipper just coming up. I was trying to wiggle in my own blood. And finally, I'll find out later, Jerry Cottingham made that doctor at least to feel my heartbeat. When I felt that hand on my chest, I made the luckiest shot I ever made in my life. I spit in the doctor's face. So the doctor says, "I think he'll make it." So I was cleaned up, put in a helicopter, alongside with my buddy, one of the guys that I had saved. We got airborne, and I just said to myself, "Hold on, buddy, just hold on. We're going to get some medical attention." And his grip tightened up on me. And then he let go. "Why do you put me through this test? Why?" You helped me get these men out, save them, save this material, and now you take them away from me. Why? And I was crying, I was moving so much that the co-pilot, he happened to look back, and he thought that I was gasping for air, so he gets out of his seat, get his bayonet out, and he's going to do a track on me, and I'm about to kick him out of the helicopter. That's just too much for one day. We landed in the hospital at Long Bend. I was wheeled to the operating room. And as I was being lifted to my operating table, I saw this nurse on her hands and knees crying, yelling, asking God, why do you do this to these men? Why? Just crying. And I turned a little bit to my left. I saw on the other operating table a man that had both legs and both arms missing. I passed out. I woke up in the ward. One of my buddies was laying next to me. We were so bandaged up, we couldn't talk. We used to wiggle our toes to make sure that we were still alive. After a short while, my buddy was transferred from there, and I thought he had died. I was transferred to Japan, Tachikawa. And the airplane that I was flying in, medevac, we lost two men. And I remember this nurse kept yelling at me, Benavides, you're not going to die on me. I'm going to pinch you every time you close your eyes. I'm going to pinch you. I'm going to pinch you. Boy, she kept pinching me. When I got to Tachikawa, when I got to Japan, and they wheeled me into the operating room, they disrobed me again. I remember the doctor, I heard him say, what in the world happened to you? I had blue spots, red spots all over me, and I said, that lady kept pinching me up there. So after, I went back to Fort Sam Houston, the Beach Pavilion, and I stayed in that hospital almost a year. I continued with my career, and then I was awarded with a medal. I was dedicating myself to come and speak to schools, to civic groups, to help anyone that I can help. My life was spared for a reason, and I hope there's a good reason. A lot of people call me a hero. I appreciate the title, but the real heroes are the ones that gave their life for this country. The real heroes are our wives, our mothers. Above all, the heroes are the ones that are laying in those hospitals, disabled for life in those hospital beds. But the real heroes are the future leaders of our country, these students that are staying in school and learning to say no to drugs. Those are our real heroes. You know, there's a saying among us veterans, for those that have fought for it, life has a special flavor that protected will never know. You have never lived till you almost died. And it is us veterans that pray for peace, most of all, especially the wounded, because we have to suffer the wounds of war. I'm asked hundreds of times, would you do it over again? In my 25 years in the military, I feel like I've been overpaid for the service to my country. There'll never be enough paper to print the money, nor enough gold in Fort Knox for me to have to keep from doing what I did. I'm proud of being American, and even prouder. And I'm even prouder that I've earned the privilege to wear the Green Beret. I live by the motto of duty, honor, country. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. Thank you. God bless you, and God bless America.
That's a feeling the protected will never know. This one here is, this is what an arrest for a bicycle helmet violation looks like in a police state.
Obstruction of law, obstruction of investigation, delaying it is a violation of one source.
Yeah.
Anybody that's on parole probation is subject to arrest and
interrogation.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, you know, this is officers doing their job.
They're not doing their job.
They are most certainly doing their job.
For a kid to be running home, man. For a kid to be running home and the police chasing, I run too. Now you saying that you got a right to write him a ticket for running from the police?
I said it and I'll say it again. They absolutely have that right.
No, you don't. That's not the truth. That's not the truth. That's not the truth, officer.
That is actually the truth.
That is not the truth. That means any kid running down the street is subject to get it. I don't have to be. You won't either.
It doesn't matter. If you interfere, you are subject to arrest. If you interfere, sir, you are...
I'm not interfering. I'm recording. I'm recording. The way y'all killing people. The way y'all killing people.
Come here. Come here.
For what?
Come here. Come here.
I got a ticket. I didn't do nothing to y'all.
Hey, you're going to get a ticket. No, either we come in there and forcibly remove you...
Why? I came on my bike and came in my yard on my porch step and got on my bike and came in the house and locked my door. I didn't do nothing to nobody.
It makes no difference. Either way, you are getting taken.
For what?
Whatever the vehicle code is allowed for.
The vehicle code?
Listen to me, I'm not going to sit here and explain myself to the juvenile. You are going to either step up or bring your motor forward or we're going to remove you. And if you have to remove you, then other charges will come. Do you understand me?
All these police for a 16-year-old kid. For a 16-year-old kid. All these police.
Be a big boy. Get your ticket.
Be a big boy. Be a big boy. Why you got to be a boy? Why you got to be a boy?
You understand me?
Sir,
you're not helping by trying to instigate anything.
I'm not instigating anything. I say fuck the police. I don't even like to fuck the police.
See,
they should take him to jail.
I told you.
There ain't no positive dialogue with you, man. Ain't no fucking positive dialogue with the fucking police. Police ain't shit. I said it. Fuck the police. I said it. He should have never went out there. He should have never went out there. All these police for a kid. All these police for a fucking 16-year-old boy.
This is what an arrest for a bicycle helmet violation looks like in a police state. This is pretty good.
Damn fucking South. This is ridiculous. And you notice all of another ethnic background. Ain't none of them black. They over here in a black people neighborhood with this bullshit. I hate these motherfuckers.
The only thing I can say is he's not helping his kid.
Yeah. If he on probation, if he on,
there's 10 cops for a helmet ticket on a bicycle. 10 cops.
It's a motherfucking shame. I hate these bastards.
outside.
Yeah, because they'll shoot my dog.
Cutting in and out, so I'm not hearing everything with clarity, and I'm only here for a brief moment in time. It's just been a real hectic day.
Yeah, no, I'm probably going to check out of here in a minute.
Okay, cool.
But, yeah, I did another one. You missed it. It was a good piece about a Master Sergeant. It's like a 25-minute video. It took 5 minutes to read a citation. So you know you're pretty badass when it takes the president 5 minutes to read your citation. But I wanted to tell you some California, according to federal penalties are being reduced by years even already for those in prison. Rule change cuts drug sentences.
Huh.
Another one. This one's called, let's see. 11. Provides individuals' First Amendment right to record police officers by stating a civilian recording while an officer is in a public place. Person recording is in a place he or she has the right to be. Not violating the law. Additionally, it makes clear that recording does not constitute reasonable suspicion to detain a person or probable cause to arrest them. It's passed in California. started in New York because New York ultimately paid $18 million to settle the resulting civil rights lawsuits.
Good. Yeah.
And for me, the timing is good given modern cell phones have turned almost everyone into a photographer and given recent nationwide news events. And Bill Ryder, Laura. Law is important at a time when cell phone and video footage is helping stir important national civil rights conversations. It's hard to have these conversations if people fear getting arrested or having their equipment confiscated. Thanks to this new law, police agencies are now going to have to cut or cast a much narrower net. But the thing I say is, undercover or walking into their house with the address shown, fair game.
Right.
So, other than that, I got a good joke for you. Want to hear this one?
No, I just look at it like this. If they could put cameras up on every stoplight, streetlight, here, there, and fucking everywhere, well, we should be able to do the same thing to protect ourselves against them.
That's it. How long have I been saying that? Forever.
Yep. You know, it's what's good for one is good for the other.
Mm-hmm.
There's got to be some equal opportunity there to level the playing field, the bullshit.
Yep. But yeah, this last video had 10 cops for a helmet taken on a bicycle.
That's just like, what's the term, overkill?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's this thing here, it touches on a big question though. Will it fundamentally change police behavior? Hey, he's a freelance journalist. His name is Ed Bauer. Been arrested 3 times under the statute. Says existing law has been vague and open to interpretation. It gives the officer a lot of leeway to arrest or cite someone. Police will now have less incentive to even approach journalists who are recording in an incident unless they are directly in the way. It's kind of a repeat of the obvious. National press noting Wells uphold the Constitution they took an oath to uphold. Work is in.
Right.
It's like chicken soup. It might not help, but it doesn't hurt. And it was a deputy sheriff who trains police agencies on media-related matters, repeated a common police expression.
I think, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I think that if we're allowed to film them or record them and what they're doing, because, you know, they can record us, I think that cops in general are going to have to stop following the rules. You know, if it's an undercover, whatever they got to do, they got to be held accountable, and it needs to be done in an orderly fashion. And the problem is that they've gotten away with it for so long, being able to do whatever they want. This is where all this has come from, you know. It's just a massive ring of friggin' violence, and there's no need of it, you know. I mean, there's no need to show that type of force if a person doesn't have any type of, weapon or dangerous whatever on them. There's just no need of it.
It's true. True. Well, you know, pick your battles.
Yep. Well, in 2 days, I will be on an island with my feet in the sand, and that's it. I, on so many levels, need this. So follow the rules. It's a 2-hour flight. That's my travel time, is 2-hour minimum.
Mm-hmm.
And it brings me to a little piece